That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
And welcome to Ladies Who London podcast. I'm Emily Dell.
And I'm Alex Lacey, and we're qualified London Blue Badge tourist guides.
Each week we bring to you some of the best bits of London.
We talk about our favourite people, places and events with a bit of information, a lot of laughs and a whole lot of fun.
We can be found on Instagram at Ladies Who London podcast and on our websites guideemily.com
and Ali. Oh, sorry, you're doing my bit. It's fine. You can do it.
Just completely spilled over there. Sorry.
That's all right. Carry on, babe. Go on. Why don't you do the last bit for once? Go on. Give it to you.
And alexlacey.com. You can do the rest.
For information about upcoming walking tours and virtual tours, as well as what the Blue Badge guiding qualification is all about.
Gosh, I mean, well, at least people know that bit is live. You know, we're not cutting and pasting every week.
We're getting slicker, I think. We're a year in and we've finally nailed how to do the entry.
Oh, God.
Honestly, why do they let us out?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Talking of being out, we are coming out of lockdown.
We're coming out of lockdown.
Slowly.
Yes. So we can meet up with six people now.
Yep.
Which is just super exciting.
It really is. And also it means that we can start doing walking tours again.
It does.
Which is really exciting. So I'm going to be putting up my walking tour dates on my website soon. I'm not going to start them immediately. I'm going to wait a few weeks and then... and then I'm going to be putting them up.
And then launch. Fantastic. Yeah, I've got some walking tours in mind that I want to do. So that'll be good. And it's sunny, Alex.
It's sunny. I don't know how long the sun's going to last, but it's sunny at the moment.
It is sunny at the moment. So we're having a good week, aren't we?
Yeah. So far, so good. Yeah, and we're going out for a nice walk on Thursday, which will be lovely.
We are.
Looking forward to that. Yay. Anyway, that's enough of Alex and Emily's tiny little world.
Oh, it is a tiny little world, isn't it? I always think, oh, God, right, I dread the question, how's your week been? Because it's like, well, it's the same as last week and the week before.
Yeah, I know. But hey.
But now that it's getting warmer and you can see people, you know, there's more things that you can do. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It sort of feels like we're... Yeah, coming out of winter, it feels a bit hopeful, doesn't it, now?
It does.
It's nice. Anyway, on with the pod. Welcome back, everybody.
Hello,
and welcome
everybody.
To any new listeners who are popping up. What are we on about this week? I'm not functioning today.
Well, should we talk about what we did last week?
Yes, let's talk about what we did last week.
So a bit of a recap. We spanned the Wheel of Destiny and it landed... Oh, God, where did it land?
I don't know. What is wrong with us?
Honestly, we're terrible. What on earth were we talking about last week? Oh, we were talking about
Ellen Terry.
Dame Ellen Terry. Yeah. Yes, so it landed over at Bankside.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about a Shakespearean actor. So I spoke about Dame Ellen Terry. We chose our podcast pedestals, didn't we?
We did. So my one was at the Lyceum Theatre, which is where you'll find The Lion King today, which is a theatre that she helped create. She helped sort of build it up, really. And in grateful thanks, her name is one of the ones around the back still listed on the side of the building, which I think is a fantastic legacy. And lovely. It's lovely that it's a theatre that's still going strong today. I think that's great.
Absolutely. And I went for her parents. Mm. Her parents were both actors. And they took Ellen absolutely everywhere. You know, they really showed her the ropes, as it were. So without her parents being actors, I don't know, would she have gone into that world? Probably not. So I think that they should be on the pedestal.
All right. Which way do you think, are you feeling confident about this one?
I think it's going to be a close one, because on my Instagram poll, there was only one point in it.
Yeah.
So
it's funny because we there was a period where they were vastly different, weren't they?
Like, yes.
And I think we've reached some kind of thing where our options are so they're so kind of challenging to each other that actually they've been very close of late, and it is very close as well this week. There's only 2 points in it.
Oh God! Last week, what was it? 1 point in it?
Something like that. I can't quite remember. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, oh gosh. Okay.
Yeah. So we've got a 38 and a 36.
Oh. got a feeling I've got the 36.
You have.
Oh, my God.
I'm not very good at building up the tension, am I? Yes, yes, that's the one you had.
Can we get a drum roll, please, next time, Alex?
Yes, okay. So 38 to the Lyceum and 36 to her parents.
Well, to be honest, you haven't won one for a couple of weeks now.
You're all right.
you're vastly ahead now. I mean, it was, what was it, 13-11, so 14-11.
14-11. Bring it on.
Well done.
Thank you.
No, it was a good
much.
Choice. It was a very good choice.
Yeah, I'm happy with that.
Her parents have let me down, so I have to have a bit of a word at some point.
I'm still a fan of the theatre industry. There we go. coming back for me.
Oh, but no, well done.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Yes.
So this week it is my go. It's my turn. My turn. and I was so thrilled when, because this is a spot that we've been wanting for quite some time, which is Greenwich.
Oh, we've been thirsty for this spot, haven't we?
We really have. So, I got Greenwich. I'm happy. Happy days. Happy days. So I was going to talk about, there's a ton of stuff, and I love Greenwich for the variety of stories that you get there. I mean, I say the variety. It's mostly naval and seafaring and all that kind of thing. And that is what we're going to be looking at today. But one of the things that, when you think of Greenwich, you think immediately of Greenwich Mean Time, the Prime Meridian. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to touch a little bit on that. And there's a story, it kind of goes together with the story of the finding of longitude. Sexy topic.
it is, isn't it? Longitude. Let's talk longitude.
But actually, do you know what? It's funny because, I'm not a scientist. I am very much a...
Oh,
I'm the black sheep in my family. My whole family are scientists, and I'm the artist. I'm the let's do a song about it kind of person. let's do a dance. And so I'm not going to be going headlong into the science because, frankly, I don't understand the science of anything. And also, that's I think that's quite boring. So we're going to be look. I'm going to be very vague on the details, well, the specific scientific details, because I don't want to get the science wrong. But it's quite a good story because it's not by chance that the Greenwich Meridian is here. It all comes back to lots of work that was done in the 1700s about finding how you could measure longitude when you're at sea. Mm-hmm. Do you know much about kind of the longitude and latitude when you're sailing? Obviously, you know, you are a seafarer. You have been on many voyages to discover breadfruit and all that kind of thing. How have you calculated your location when you've been at sea?
Well, you know, I have, my parents live on the Isle of Wight, so I have had many boat trips, many boat trips. So when it comes to longitude, if you think about the globe, the longitude are the vertical lines that go along the globe. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So, and the latitude are the horizontal lines.
Yeah.
So, what was the question again?
I don't think it's one you're going to be able to answer anyway. Because how would you calculate your position?
Oh right, well I'd probably, you know, if I was back in the 1700s, probably look up at the sun.
Oh, well, the sun's not going to help you much. The stars will help you.
Yes, but if I leave it at a particular time when the sun is at the highest point, then I can calculate how long I've gone.
Oh, I see. I don't know how. Yeah, but the sun moves quite quickly. I don't know. Anyway, the stuff in the sky basically is what we're coming down to.
Yes, the sky. I'd look sky up, stuff. Alex. I'd admire the sky and be like, "Gosh, I'm sure I've been sailing for 2 hours now." Actually, who cares? It's such a lovely voyage.
Exactly. Exactly. Breadfruit, ahoy! Now, okay. So, if you think about it, Britain, we are an island. Therefore, if you want to do stuff, if you want to go and explore, or you want to go and bring in produce, it necessitates sailing. So we've always been a sailing nation, because that, by design, that's what we are. And you know, traveling by sea was always slow and very quite dangerous, actually, during the time of sail. And you know, ships who would be carrying, well, cargo or passengers or anything really, loads of them would meet a bit of a sticky end at sea and just simply would never be heard from again. And it was often quite usual for boats, especially along the coastline, to get caught in storms and be driven ashore and all this kind of thing. And so it's a really, really tricky tricky little chap to be able to navigate correctly when you don't have anything that can tell you exactly where you are. So the problem is that longitude is much, much harder to calculate than latitude. The Earth rotates 360 degrees per day, which, if you want the specifics, is about 15 degrees an hour. And so there is a direct relationship between the longitude where you are and the time that the sun rises and sets. So you have got the sun in there, but of course, depending on where you are, it's going to depend what time it sets. So the sun sets an hour earlier every 15 degrees east or west of the prime meridian that you go. Mm-hmm. And the problem was, there was no real way of finding out your longitude. Latitude was fine, you could calculate that, but longitude was the problem, because you needed to kind of know how long you'd been sailing for, how far away from port, because of course, as you move, the day, you know, every time you move a degree, if you were staying in London, you'd know that the sun set at, say, 7 o'clock, for argument's sake. But the minute you start moving a few degrees across, you know, you're lengthening or you're shortening your day. So you then can't say, well, the sun set at 7 o'clock, because 7 o'clock where? So it's really, really tricky. Mm. And so they needed clocks in order to figure out where they were and how long they'd been sailing for. But the trouble is, the clocks that they had on board ships were the same as you'd have on land. So often these pendulum clocks, which the minute that you introduce sort of wiggly gravity, and by that I mean all the kind of the waves sloshing around, and your, you know, temperature changes as well, which is going to expand or contract the metal, the clock just loses time almost instantly. So it's completely useless for figuring out where you are.
Yeah, it's going to be going all over the shop. I mean, especially if you hit a bit of a storm.
Yeah, especially if you hit a storm, that'll turn you around and you won't have a clue. And then you'll get to bits where you think you're in one place, but actually you're in somewhere completely different. Mm. And that can be very dangerous, because if you think that you're in the, you know, with loads and loads of leagues below you, but actually you've got coral that's coming up and, you know, you could ground your ship. And this is what would happen, is people would, that the ships would run aground and lives and cargo would be lost. And it was dreadful. And it all comes to a head. Now, I mentioned his name last week, and I think he has the best name, Sir Cloudesley Shovel.
Oh, yes.
Which is a brilliant name. I love that so a baby is born and they go, let's call him Cloudesley.
Cloudesley.
Yeah, if anyone out there listening and expecting a baby, please, please call it Cloudesley.
Call it Cloudesley. Little Cloud. I mean, Cloud is quite cute, but then Cloudesley sounds like some kind of cheese.
It does, actually. Like a really kind of, a really goaty one.
A really goaty, milky, musty one.
Yes. One that tastes like the farm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, Cloudesley Shovel, who is a bit of a dude, he is an admiral, and he takes his fleet in early 1700s. He takes his fleet, he's traveled from Gibraltar, and he's aiming obviously for England, and they get this really stormy weather for about 10 days. So he's all turned around and they can't see the stars, so they can't make these astronomic measurements and observations, and he's forced to kind of navigate just by sort of figuring out, just going, I think we're here, essentially. It's not just quite out of his head. There's speed estimates and compass readings and this, that and the other. And his reckoning on this one particular day, the storm has passed, and he thinks that he is nearing land and that he's got a good, you know, stretch of water below him and the sky's clear a little bit so he can make some, you know, astronomic observations. And he can't quite figure out exactly where he is, but he thinks that they are just off the coast of France. So he thinks, right, if that's where we are, we're going to sail northeast and that's going to carry us safely into the English Channel. And so he issues the orders and off goes the fleet. And however, he had got the location completely wrong. He was already off towards the northwest, very, very close to the Scilly Isles.
Oh, so Cloudsley, what are you doing, man?
So when he goes, right, off you go that way, chaps, basically he ends up shoving them straight into the Scilly Isles. They run aground, the entire fleet, and there's about 2,000 men that are killed, including Sir Cloudsley Shovel himself. And this is where we start to get actually a very big change, where they bring in a thing called the Board of Longitude to solve this problem. And the reason is Cloudsley Shovel was he was quite well loved, but also you've suddenly got, because normally when these ships are running aground, they're off in the middle of goodness knows where and it doesn't really affect people at home, and suddenly you've got Britons who are having the bodies of these men who've been died at sea or died in, you know, in this breaching of the fleet, and they're sort of washing up on the shores of Britain. And this, of course, is you know, just massive big deal. And so they set up this Board of Longitude, and this is quite a good little strategy by the Parliament, because instead of by putting it onto essentially the scientific community, they've gone, right, we can't solve this, Isaac Newton himself can't even solve it, so what do you expect us to do? We're going to open up this thing and we're going to ask the scientific community to solve this problem for us. So quite cleverly, they've shifted the blame away from them, because for years they've done nothing about it, because it's kind of, oh, if you can't see that problem, don't have to worry about it. But the minute you can see it on British shores, that's when the Parliament sort of realise, oh, we've got to do something. And they, by shifting the sort of focus onto science to create a solution, it kind of shifts the blame away from them a little bit, or shifts the focus away from them at any rate. Very clever, really.
Right, crikey. Yeah. Did you know there's a pub called the Ship and Shovel, named after Cloudsley?
Yeah, right in the centre of London.
Yeah, it's a beautiful pub. It's actually in two parts, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's split over a road. Well, a little passageway. Quite unusual. I was thinking I might do an Instagram post on that at some point soon.
Yes, I think you should.
Yeah, I think I might. Anyway, so we get this Board of Longitude that is set up, and the aim is basically to, they bring in an act in 1714 called the Longitude Act, and they are offering money in return for a solution to this problem. So they need somebody to find a solution to create something that means that these ships can accurately determine their longitude, and therefore these problems are not going to happen again. So it's quite a big deal, really, and it becomes quite a kind of coveted thing to be appointed to the Board of Longitude, because these guys, by sort of shifting this focus away from Parliament and away from all these sort of shipping magnates who have not, you know, for ages not really bothered with a solution, it means that they're free to kind of still travel, and they still get reimbursement for expenses as well for carrying out their duties. So it's quite a coup to be appointed to this board, but it also means it's quite good for astronomers, because of course that this Longitude Act, where they're trying to create the solution, they're kind of saying to the astronomers, you know, this is your ballpark, this is what you guys do, you're looking at the stars, figure out something for us to do. So there we go. So it's quite good, because these astronomers can actually do a lot of travel, they can go and do all sorts of paid research and that kind of thing. So we come on to a chap called John Harrison. I love John Harrison.
You've got to love a bit of John Harrison.
He's so good. So he hears about this this Longitude Act, and he pops up in London and decides that he is going to look for a bit of support and essentially win this prize and get himself cachet and this financial reward. So he decides that the way he's going to do it is to devise some kind of clock or timekeeping mechanism that is going to work on board the ships.
Right.
And he wants to create something that will keep time to within 3 seconds a day. Now, to us now, that's like, fair enough. But that would make it more accurate than even some of the best watches of the time.
God, and this is 1714.
1714, I mean, yeah.
People would have thought, oh, you're mad. You're mad if you think that you can achieve this.
Yeah, I know, exactly. And he does. And he actually achieves it on the very first go, which is amazing.
Oh, so, what a guy.
What a guy. So Harrison comes to London. He starts working with Edmund Halley, who is an astronomer royal. And Edmund Halley is also a commissioner of longitudes. He's part of this board as well. So he's been, you know, getting information from Halley and getting help with the stars, all this kind of stuff. So he decides that he is going to start his attempt on his first timekeeping mechanism, which is now known as H1. And if you go to Greenwich, which I strongly recommend you do because it's one of my favourite places in London, at the top of the hill, where there you have the Greenwich Meridian, which we're going to come on to, and you also have the Royal Observatory, and in there you have John Harrison's timepieces. So you can go and see all of these. They're quite incredible. When you look at the back, or you get to see the inner workings of a clock, and you see all those little cogs and everything ticking around. Mm. It's like that, but on a much bigger scale. It's quite fascinating, actually.
Mm. So intricate.
Really,
and it's lovely because
really
you can hear like the tick, 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 and you can see the pendulums of the bigger ones that he tried out beforehand, and you just see it getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, and they kind of there's three quite chunky ones, and then suddenly there's this teeny weeny pocket watch.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
He suddenly did a massive leap, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. So the first few years, he actually doesn't work in London. He works in Barrow-upon-Humber, so up in Yorkshire, on this H1, as it's known. And he tests it on the River Humber, and it works. It's amazing. He brings it to London in 1735, and it seems that he has cracked this problem. One of the things it has is two what look like pendulums. So they're sort of interconnected, but they sort of swing at opposite directions to each other, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I can't quite figure out how to say that, but and the reason for this is that it means that this movement of the ship that you've got, it doesn't affect it. It's still able to keep time itself. So it's a portable version of something that he's already created, which is like a wooden kind of clock. And so they look at it and they go, all right, this could be good. So they call for a trial. And the following year, Harrison and his clock, or his timekeeping piece, were put aboard a ship going off to Portugal. And they wanted to test it in a live setting. So the Portugal trip goes out to Lisbon. It doesn't start brilliantly, but by the time they get there, the machine is working better, and they bring him back on another ship. And this one, on the way back, is much, much more successful. And as they come towards England, the officers on board ship have seen some land, and they say, oh, it's this chunk of land here. And Harrison says, actually, no, due to my calculations with my H1, it's actually this chunk of land, which is the Lizard in Cornwall. And he was right. And that meant that they were 60 miles off course and in imminent danger. So right there, his H1 is verified. It's like, yep, that's fine. It's working fine. So he brings it back, you know, it gets off the ship, and this is where the longitude, the board of longitudes start to get a little bit kind of, you know, because essentially they've got this chunk of money, this prize, but turns out they're not that happy about giving it out, really, which is interesting.
Oh, that's very strange,
I know,
isn't it?
What a
I'm
shock,
surprised
what
they'd
a
want
shock.
To hold that money back.
I know, that never happened.
Okay, so is John kind of like saying, hey guys, you know, H1, it's a success, give me my money?
Well, so they say what they do is they bring it forward to this essentially a sort of a meeting, really a formal meeting of these all commissioners, and they come together in 1737 and they decide to discuss what they've termed his curious instrument, which I think is a rather cheeky way of something that he's created, which they've asked him to create. But anyway,
yeah.
And so they get together and they agree that a payment of £500. And they pay him £250 up front to allow him to build an improved version of this.
How much, what was the prize money? What did they first say? Oh, this is what you get if you succeed in the longitude mission.
So the prize fund had been set at £20,000, which in today's money would be several million pounds.
Whoa.
Now, it's not clear whether or not that would all have gone to one person or whether they were going to reward anybody who came up with an option for it. But obviously, when they say, well, we're going to give you 500 quid, it's not really so much of a prize as it is we're going to try and sort of fund you to make a better version. So it's a little bit cheeky, but I guess, it's, I suppose, at the same time, you know, you want to make sure you've got something that can be replicated and that works okay. So, you know, you're not going to hand out millions for just going, oh, you've created something. It's not the perfect version of it. But yeah, anyway, so essentially he hasn't got his hands on the cash just yet.
Okay.
So he promises to make another version, an improved version, and he does more experiments on two more, H2 and H3. Mm-hmm. H2 doesn't actually ever go to trial because he discovers quite a key flaw in it. So he takes what he's learned from that one and he goes on to H3. And he, even though he's promised them one within 2 years, he spends 19 years working on it.
Does he have a family? Because I can imagine this taking over every inch of his day.
Yeah, I mean, it must have done. I honestly don't know if he's got a family or not. I haven't really looked into his personal life, but yeah, I mean, I can, yeah, it would have been a lifetime, dedicated to this, really.
Mm.
And I should say, it doesn't take him 19 years to do it properly. Within five years, he's created H3 and it's being tested. Mm-hmm. But he's finding flaws with it and he's kind of tweaking and improving all the rest of the time. And then he gets to H4. Now, this is around the 1750s by this point. So a good chunk of time has gone on. And he finds a new way of doing something, which is to have a new type of balance in it, which it's in a pocket watch, and he uses a kind of bimetal strip, which means that, so it's two different metals, so as you're going between different areas where it's hotter or it's colder, the two strips are kind of, again, the science, I'm not going to go too much into it because I don't really get the science, but essentially it means that they can contract and expand and keep the whole thing running at the correct rate. So okay. It's very, very, and if you look at his tomb, which is in Westminster Abbey, there are two little strips of metal, a bimetal strip on it as well, which is rather sweet. Mm-hmm. His commemorative plaque in Westminster Abbey. It's rather nice little detail, actually. So he incorporates this into this H4, which is essentially a pocket watch, and nobody. So obviously, people have had pocket watches, but nobody had really seen it as a serious precision timekeeper. And so while H4, I mean, it does look like a pocket watch, but realistically, it's a lot more complex. So there's a lot more in it. It's you can hear, if you listen to it, when you go and see it, I don't know if you can quite hear it through the cabinet it's in, but it ticks really, really rapidly. It ticks 5 times a second. So it's got this new balance in there and it beats much more quickly and with much faster, a much faster pace than a typical watch, and this helps it keep time. So as well, this Board of Longitude has given they've given parameters for what they want. So any of these timepieces that are being made have to keep time within a certain amount of loss per day, and even H1 is well within those boundaries. So he's really, you know, he's smashing it out of the park. And so in 1761, the commissioners decide that, okay, H4 is ready to go on voyage. We can go and trial it. And it goes on board ship to Jamaica. And the trial goes really well. It's used to predict a much earlier landfall at Madeira than the crew were expecting. And the captain is so impressed with this that he says, look, I would actually like to buy your next version of this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you know, even the captain, they're going off to Jamaica and he's only got to Madeira. And the captain's already like, yeah, I'm on board. Like, I'm properly on board.
Hey, we need to have a little bit of a chat down in the galley.
Yeah, exactly. And there's quite a big name who takes the clock on board. Captain Cook. He takes four. Mm. He goes down to his second big voyage, which is in the 1770s. He takes 4 sea clocks aboard his boat as he's going. So 4 different ones that, you know, have been created through this thing, because of course John Harrison's not the only one who's trying to crack this. So that one of them is a copy of Harrison's H4.
Okay.
And there were other 3 different clocks made from different designs and this sort of thing, and one of them, Captain Cook does say that it keeps time, and it's a great phrase, in such a manner as not to be complained upon. So, you know, it's doing the job. It's doing the
it's
job.
It's fine. It's fine. Okay.
But Harrison's one, he is much less measured. He bloody loves it.
Oh,
he is really enthusiastic, and he bangs on about it, and it says it's been found to answer beyond all expectation.
Oh, bloody
so he
hell.
Is properly, he's loving this one. And he, yeah, one of the best things about it, he says that it's so accurate that rather than being able to, you know, if you've got a clock that's accurate-ish, you can take the thing and then you've got to do quite a few measurements and this, that and the other and figure out exactly where you are. But he says this one is so accurate that it's really simple. You just take a few observations and you can do that directly there and you know exactly where you are. It's really, really good.
God. And coming from Cook as well, yeah. who, you know, at this point in the late 1700s has probably done multiple journeys and various adventures and things. So he knows what he's talking about. He knows what he's looking for.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic.
Exactly. Exactly. And so that's worked. He's done his job. This is perfect. So he brings it back and is presenting, you know, all of this. We've got Cook. We've got this captain going down to Jamaica as well. Everyone's going, yeah, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. We love it. So it comes back to the Board of Longitude. What do you think they do?
Well, I'm guessing then they're a little reluctant to hand over the money.
Yes, they are not up for coughing up, basically.
No.
Which is just so cheeky. You know, he's been working at this since, you know, the
1714,
and it's now we're now into the 1770s. I mean, yeah. So,
and I guess like the people on the board have probably changed through the years as well. So some have probably been a little bit tighter than others,
maybe,
that was them. They discussed this. We're a new board, or.
I mean, probably, let's face it, that's the kind of thing that always happens, isn't it? Well, that might be what they've always done, but we're not going to do that. Anyway, yeah, I know, hilarious. I love that idea of, yeah, the kind of the Jackie Weaver of the 1700s.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they decide that the test is not sufficient. They reckon that actually it's not enough and blah, blah, blah. And this is where really the relationship between the Harrison and the board starts to deteriorate, because of course Harrison's been working in very good faith for the best part of what, 60 years?
Gosh.
to create something that works, that fulfills their brief. And you know, by this point it's not about the month, well it is obviously, but it is about, this is a lifetime project for him, like you say, and he's spent his whole life working on this, and you know, he got it right the first time, and he's made it better and better and better, and he's now suddenly going, hang on, we've worked together for 60 years and now you're telling me that it's not good enough. So loads of his friends and supporters, they start a campaign. Newspaper articles, pamphlets, which were a very big deal. Pamphlets were a great way of getting your message out in times gone by. All sorts of stuff. And they basically, they start this sort of war, the propaganda war, really, in the press. And in the meantime, other methods have been coming up. So we heard about a couple of the others that have gone on Captain Cook's ship, and there's about two others that are possibly going to rival his, but clearly Harrison's, you know, we heard what Captain Cook said, clearly Harrison's is very much the front runner and really, really spectacularly accurate. So,
but I bet you've got a lot of copycat people at this point, because if it's going on and on, you know, in terms of these pamphlets being given out and the board not listening to them, other people who have the technical know-how but don't necessarily know the direction to go will look at H4 and completely copy it and try and make it a little bit better and I guess gain that money.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, it's really quite... Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of competition. Of course, this is why they do this for things. They did it for Tower Bridge as well. They set up a whole variety of competitions, and you know, that you could submit your, because they want to see what's out there. They want to see who's got the ideas, and just because one idea is great doesn't mean another idea isn't, and all that kind of thing. So, but clearly Harrison has put the work in, and he's, you know, his stuff is the best.
Yes.
So it takes quite a lot of strong arming, and I think actually even the king gets involved to kind of give him a bit of a nudge, and eventually the board recommends that Parliament should award Harrison £10,000, for this H4, and the remaining £10,000, minus the payments that have already been made, like 60 years ago, would be awarded once it was shown that other makers could produce similar timekeepers. So essentially, they want to make sure it's not a one-off, and that this can be then made, it multiplied and made so that people can have them on the ships. There's no point having one thing that works, but actually nobody else can make it, and you can't make any more.
Right.
So, which is fairly prudent, I think, fairly prudent. So eventually, now Harrison, he believed that the full rule was already due under the terms of the Act, and that the commissioners had actually changed the rules. So that's quite an interesting take. And the recommendations then became law under a law in 1765. So he didn't feel all that he didn't get all that he was owed. And, like I say, the king sort of stepped in to help that go forward. But he is remembered in history as solving the problem of longitude, which I think is an incredible thing, because of course we see, you know, seafaring and all the sort of navigational stuff today would not have gone to anything if it hadn't been for John Harrison and his amazing H4.
Definitely. And I guess with the competition, it sped things up. You know, naturally things might have taken a slower turn. But if it wasn't for Cloudesley and the competition, I mean, I'm not trying to give you podcast pedestal ideas here, but, suddenly you've got this G-force behind solving this problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And I have to tell you, there is something that I really love about this story. And it's some of the completely mad, one in particular, completely mad idea that somebody put forward. Because, of course, whenever you put this sort of competition out, you're going to get some crazies.
You're going to get a couple of oddballs.
Yeah. Yeah, you're gonna get one. And one of my favourites...
Time freaks.
time freaks. One of my favourites is a guy called Sir Kenelm Digby. So this guy's a sir. So he's, in theory, you know, not just some wacko from the pub.
Kenelm.
Kenelm, great name, right? And his... Now, this is honestly my favourite thing ever. I mean, it's awful, but it's my favourite thing. So he proposed that you would wound a dog... Bear with me. You would wound a dog with a knife or something and place the dog on each ship. All right. Then something associated with that dog, so either the bandage that was around its leg or whatever it was, or the knife that we used to make the wound, would remain at the home port. And then at midday, you would plunge whatever it was, so the knife or the bandage or whatever, into something called the powder of sympathy. Whatever this powder was, I have no idea, but the powder of sympathy, and this meant that the effect of this powder would cause pain in the dog's wound thousands of miles away, would cause it to howl, and then you would know that it was midday.
Oh, so if
in your home port.
You know, if, let's say, John has stabbed the dog,
yep.
His wife, Margaret, says, don't worry, I'm going to put it in the powder at 1 o'clock. So get ready for the dog to yell.
Yeah.
It will be at 1 o'clock.
Yeah. So then, when the dog howls at 1 o'clock or midday, whatever it is, you know that that's the time back home, and so you might be, you know, 17 hours ahead, but you know that it's 1 o'clock. So you still know. That's how you're going to know where you are in relation to. Yeah. I mean,
that is absolutely bonkers. I mean, what about the dog? I mean,
well, I know this poor
any
dog.
Any sympathy for the dog?
I mean, of course not.
God,
might get some
there
scraps.
Are many questions, aren't there? I mean, the powder, talcum powder. I mean, what kind of powder? What did you call it?
Powder of sympathy.
Sympathy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I
don't quite know what.
A lack of sympathy, really.
I mean, I just don't. It's amazing. It's. I mean, who on earth would think that that is? It is.
But did he actually trial it? Was this
trial? No, I wouldn't have thought so. I wouldn't have thought so, no.
Well, he probably did trial it, Alex. He probably thought, well, you know, if I haven't got back in, I'll do it myself.
Yeah, I mean, just completely mad. God. Completely mad. But anyway, so that's just one of the brilliant ideas that was put forward. That's the most, I think that's the maddest one. There we go. So this gives us the sense that London and Greenwich in particular is kind of the heart of all of this timekeeping at sea and being a naval nation. It's, you know, it's a very big deal. So we come to the prime meridian, the Greenwich meridian, the mean time, whatever you want to call it. And why is it in Greenwich? Why is the zero in Greenwich? So firstly, what is a meridian? as you mentioned earlier, it's these north-south lines, which you have one which is the zero, and then essentially for kind of astronomical observations it starts as, and then you can build up an accurate map of the sky from, if you start from that one particular spot and then you kind of move. So you need the zero one as well for when you start to time zone everything out. So up until this point, time is quite a relative concept, which is a very big statement, but essentially what that means is that there wasn't any standardized time. So in London it could be at 5 o'clock, but then in Guildford it might be 6:45 or whatever. And people, and so this is when you start to get the trains starting with the Industrial Revolution. You need to have a standardized time, because otherwise train timetables are going to mean nothing. If they say it leaves at 7 o'clock from London, but it arrives in Southampton at 4:45, it doesn't mean anything, does it? And people won't know where to go and what time to get the train and all that kind of thing. So it's around this time that we see this happening. And it's decided that you need a zero. And then every place on Earth is measured in terms of its distance east or west from that line. And so the question arises, where do we put the zero? Where does the zero line have to go that makes the most sense for the most people? And Greenwich is chosen. Now, interestingly, it's chosen in 1884, so actually quite late, in a conference that's in Washington, D.C. 25 nations all meet together to decide where it is. And one of the things that some of the reasons they look at is that the USA has already chosen Greenwich as the basis for its own national time zone system, almost certainly because, you know, coming from the UK, lots of people moved to America and they would have set things up related to what they had back at home. So that makes sense. Also, in the late 19th century, 72% of the world's commerce depends very heavily on sea charts which use Greenwich as the centre. Already they've got this sort of de facto zero at Greenwich. So it's sort of decided that realistically keeping it at Greenwich is going to be the most helpful to the most amount of people. And so it's voted on at this conference in Washington, D.C. in 1884. There were 22 votes in favour, one vote against Santo Domingo, and two abstentions. One is Brazil. Can you guess which country abstained as well? One of our
France.
Yes, exactly. I love it. They haven't said no, but they've kind of gone huffy that England's got it. But anyway, yes,
so France also abstained. Right underneath, I mean, if you follow the line from Greenwich going down, you get to Paris, which is where
You get to Portugal.
Oh, do you get Portugal? Yeah. So not on the Paris line?
No, Paris is slightly further over. But I mean, it's not far off, but yeah. But you go through Portugal, which is why Portugal's got the same time zone as the UK. But I just love that. They're kind of like, well, I guess it's fine, but I don't really want to give you the seal of approval. Oh, the French, we love to hate them. They love to hate us. It's a beautiful thing. So there we go. So that is why Greenwich was selected as zero. So if you do go to Greenwich, you can stand at the top of the hill with one foot either side of the meridian, and you can theoretically be half in the eastern hemisphere and half in the west. And also, if you go up the country, not just in London, but all the way through, you can find little roundels in the floor, and that will show you exactly where the meridian line runs. So there are some through Greenwich, but there are some also going up through London and up above that as well.
Cool.
So you always know where you are in relation. And there's a little shop in Greenwich, which I'm sure you know, Emily, at the bottom, which calls itself the first shop in the world.
Yeah.
Which I rather like because of its location close to the Greenwich Meridian. Although I think they failed to realise that there is a gift shop at the top of the hill, which is practically slap bang on the primary.
Yeah.
Never mind. But I love that they've gone with that. So it's the first shop to the west of that meridian. So there we go. So that is it. That is Greenwich.
I love
time
that.
And tide and clocks.
The observatory is just such a fascinating space. And when you take people up there and they stand with a leg on either side, it's wonderful, isn't it? And you've got all the little other countries listed, so you can see exactly how far behind or in front they are in terms of time.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that, Alex. Thank you so much.
That's all right. I love Greenwich, and I just love I love the naval history and all that kind of stuff. I'm a water baby anyway, but so it speaks to me. But I find it so fascinating that that so much of his life was dedicated to it. It's quite.
Definitely. So did he get the full money in the end? Because he got given 10,000.
Mostly. He managed to extract kind of most
beforehand?
Of it. Yeah, I think he didn't. Actually, I think it was his family that who were fighting for it at the end. I'm not sure who in his family. So I don't know if it was, kids and wife, or if it was brothers and sisters and things like that. I'm not sure. But I think, yeah, at the end, it was his family who sort of fought for the last bit. They did manage to extract most of it. Not everything. But, this poor guy has worked his entire life and doesn't even really see the fruits of his labours. But here we go.
But now, I mean, he's got such a legacy behind his name when you think of time and when you think of longitude, which I often do, you think of Harrison.
Yeah.
So although he didn't get as much money as he should have, in terms of how recognised he is and what he did for the world, it's astonishing.
Legacy, proper legacy. So there we go. Yay. Licky John Harrison. And nobody died this week. Well, Clousy Shovel died. But apart from
Clousley,
that.
Don't forget Clousley.
Yeah, Clousley in the 2000
potentially
men.
The dog.
One of the dogs wounded, so the dog's still alive. So not too much death and destruction this week, which is pretty decent. Yeah.
Pretty decent. And I don't think we had any last week, so.
I don't think we did.
We're doing well.
Yay!
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. Podcast Pedestal.
Podcast Pedestal toppers, what are you going for?
Gosh. Can you give me the quote again from Cook when Cook was so overjoyed?
Yeah, he said it had been found to answer beyond all expectation.
Oh. So you said that time wasn't going to be sexy, but I think that's
it's the way I said it, isn't
sexy.
It?
It is actually, yeah. I think I'm going to go with the Cook quote.
Damn it!
I think this is the first time that I've picked you're going to pick.
Yes, you've usurped me. All right, okay. It's all right, I have a backup. So you're going to go for, not for Cook, but for his quote in particular.
For his quote. I'm going to go for his quote.
Okay, interesting. All right. Well, I'm going to go then for Cloudsley Shovel. Partly because his name is so brilliant. But also partly because the fact that, he was run aground and died and all this sort of stuff and died on the coast of the UK precipitated this problem solving. Because like I say, the government had not really been bothered doing anything because they were like, problems that don't really happen on our doorstep. So good old Cloudsley Shovel. I think his sort of go this way chaps slightly renegade attitude without all the proper information was the catalyst for creating this incredible thing. And if they hadn't done it then, it would have been years later and maybe John Harrison mightn't have done it and wouldn't have been a big success or whatever. So good old Cloudsley Shovel, taking one for the team.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. If I wasn't going to go for the quote, I'd probably go for Cloudsley myself. Ooh. So we'll see. We'll see next week, Alex.
Okay. Well, that's it. Those are your options, everybody. We have the quote by Captain James Cook, and we have Sir Cloudsley Shovel martyring himself on the shores of the UK for the greater good.
Excellent. Oh, no, that was lovely. Thank you very much indeed.
All right, before we find out where we're going to go next week, do you have anything coming up?
Only that I have a garden tour on the 24th. I had to think about that then. So in an English country garden on the 24th of April. And this one is at when's this one? 2 p.m. It's an hour and a half. It's £10 per person. I'm going to be taking you around the country to some of the most beautiful gardens we have here in England.
Amazing.
And yes, I'm going to be putting up on my website a few walking tours in the near future.
Fab. Yay. I'm so excited to get back out doing walking tours. So for me, yes, I'm just putting some dates up for walking tours on my website. I'm not going to do them immediately. I'm going to do them in a few weeks from now, but they're going up. And the results are in for the next series of virtual tours as well. So they're going up, and I will be putting booking open for that as well. So I will let you know a bit more about that next week. Yay!
Lovely jubbly!
The Wheel of Destiny.
Right. So it is your favourite time of the week.
It's time for the wheel.
Yep.
There is something that I want to talk about.
Okay.
That I'd like to talk about.
Is it death and destruction?
There is a little bit of death and quite a lot of destruction.
Oh, God. You're so...
But it's very interesting.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah. So I'm just... I mean, I might not be able to... Well, to be honest, I'm just going to spin the wheel and see what happens.
Oh, okay. Is this one of those ones that you can put in any area and you're just going to do it anyway?
Alex, just let me spin the wheel, for heaven's sake.
All right, go for it.
Okay. Oh, it has. It's landed in Mayfair.
Okay. I feel like she's pulling a fast one here. Anyone else?
No, it's definitely landed in Mayfair. But you are right. In terms of what I want to talk about, it basically covered the whole of London.
You've been talking about doing something like this for a while, doing an outlier.
It was quite a dramatic event. I'm going to be talking about the Great Smog of 1952.
Oh, epic. All right.
Yeah. Oh, you don't sound too excited for
this.
No,
I am.
The Great Smog.
The Great Smog.
The
I
great
can't believe
smog.
It.
Yeah.
So excited. Is that better?
Thank you. Yes, that's a bit better. Yes, I'm going to be talking about the Great Smog. And although, yes, there is death and destruction, but it's such a huge event that took over quite a few days. And it's just really interesting how people reacted to it, how they didn't react to it. The things they had in place, it's just in my opinion fascinating.
I'm so. Yay. Brilliant. Well, that's next week's one.
Lovely.
There we go. All right, well, listen, thank you everybody for coming. Go and vote. The polls will be up on Sunday. Again, you can drop us an email if you like, and we will see you next week for a bit of great smog action.
Yay. Have a lovely week, everybody. Enjoy the sun if it's on you.
Take care, everyone. Bye.
Bye.